At this point, I'm hoping there are people in the audience who might have questions. We see two already over on the south side of the pilot house, three, in fact. So let me turn things over to WUWM's Bob Bach, who is moving his way through the audience now. Raise your hand, and he will help you direct your question.
I'd like to know, explore a possibility of, instead of trying to choose which energy input we're working with, trying to reduce outputs. What if there were a carbon tax? And I'd like to ask each of you, or whoever you want, instead of whether it's good or bad, how would a carbon tax affect your choices or your business decisions if it were displacing all of the other subsidies, which is to say we have no subsidies for any energy type anymore, but we're instead trying to reduce emission outputs?
Gary Radloff, you are the policy guy at the table. Actually, we have a number of policy people, but let me start with you anyway.
Well, I do think at some point we will have a carbon tax. I think it would significantly change behaviors, both in the industry sector, in the individual lifestyle sector. You know, the flip side of it right now is, quite frankly, we don't adequately capture in our energy prices the fact that we do subsidize some of the environmental degradation that occurs from our energy sources. We do subsidize some of the public health losses because of our current energy sources. So a carbon tax would sort of reverse that trend, if you will. I also think it really puts a very real price on energy generation. So I think it would dramatically change the marketplace and really, I think, just because I am a policy geek, I apologize. I think it's preferable to cap and trade because cap and trade is, you know, can be a little bit gamed. Cap and trade is kind of almost like a stock market approach to solving the problem. Just put a real dollar price on carbon, and I think a carbon tax does that. So I think it's inevitable. I will not tell you when I think it's going to happen because I don't know, but I think it's inevitable.
Others on the panel want to take on the issue of the carbon tax?
I guess I would. When we put together projects for our clients, it takes into account the energy costs, the rebates, the tax credits, and we show them an entire, you know, spreadsheet that shows all of their alternatives. And certainly a carbon tax would be one that we would capture on there. It would inspire people to do bigger and larger energy efficiency and renewable energy projects, for sure.
Andy Hasselbach, you look like you have something to add.
From a utility perspective, it would be, just as we look at limits on mercury, NOx, SOx, other emittances as dictating or influencing how we dispatch our facilities, a carbon tax would be another factor. It would tend to do more natural gas generation, and renewables may come into the mix depending on their price point. With natural gas coming down, actually, gas has been used, really been growing in its use at our facilities. So there has been a migration based on the economics of gas, but it would do that. And as I mentioned at the beginning, I think sometimes efficiency at traditional facilities can deliver as much of a bang or perhaps even more at times than some renewable technologies, simply because you're putting the same energy in or the same energy in and the greater outputs. So that increment is without any increase in emissions. So I think you'd see more focus on efficiency at existing facilities, in addition to looking at non-emitting technologies.
Shala Werner, would you or the Sierra Club like to see something like this?
I'm going to answer just on behalf of me in this question because the Sierra Club did support the cap and trade bill, and we saw it as a good balance of interests at the time. I mean, the first cap and trade policy was the first President Bush put in effect to reduce the impacts of acid rain, and that was effective in that case. But I do agree with Gary that in the case of carbon tax, I think that could be much better than cap and trade because of the potential to game the system. Now, I won't say that it's a panacea. Something like a technical fix, like allowing third-party ownership, isn't going to be fixed by a carbon tax. If we could stomach that idea on the national level, I do think that it's something that would be supported by almost every environmental group. It makes sense. It's very straightforward.
Anyone else want to add before? Why don't we move on to our next question? And if you could introduce yourself, tell us who you are and where you're from, that'd be great.
Matt Howard, Sustainability Director for the city, from right down the block. Very interesting panel, and I thought it was a great question on carbon tax. So I don't know if I have a point or a question, but I get very annoyed when people talk about the free market and renewable energy. As a reformed economist, I'm very familiar with what a free market looks like. And in this state and in this country, we have a highly regulated market when it comes to energy production, generation, and distribution. It's anything but free. It's monopolistic. I think we've heard that a couple times. And monopolies exist to promote their own best interests and to perpetuate their model of earning money. And I think what we really need to do as consumers, because we all like choice and option, we need to have an honest discussion with ourselves. Do we actually have a choice or an option? I kind of feel like a Yugoslavian in 1980, and the government is telling me I have to drive a Yugo, and I don't want to drive a Yugo. And so I think my question is, how much longer do we have to drive Yugos in this country? We need to have a real conversation about what this marketplace looks like, and it is, does it exist in the best interest of the ratepayer?
Let me take his question one step further. Is there anything philosophically different about consuming energy than there is about buying a car or an artichoke or anything else? Should we have the same choice in energy that we have in everything? And Deborah Irwin, why don't you jump in?
Utilities in the state of Wisconsin in particular are regulated monopolies. And so it's not a free market, obviously. You have a utility that serves your area, and that's their service territory, and you don't get to choose whoever you want to provide your electricity. And that's basically part of the regulatory compact that we have in the state and that any regulated state has, and that in exchange for those monopoly service territories, they are regulated by the state and by the Public Service Commission. And so, you know, the Public Service Commission's regulation role is there to protect the public interest. But yes, of course, they are monopolies.
Anyone else?
As Matt was saying that monopoly comment, it brought to mind a whole bunch of examples that I read about recently. One is, interestingly, the Georgia Tea Party group is actually pushing to challenge the monopoly law in their state that allows utilities to basically, you know, control the energy use of their citizens. And I mean, can you imagine? It's the Tea Party, and they're looking at this and they're saying, wow, Georgia, it's pretty sunny here. Why can't we have anything else? And so I think that one thing that's really encouraging about that is that, you know, this doesn't have to be a partisan issue. But another thing is we really should look at, you know, I think the public is getting frustrated with the lack of policy leadership. Another example that comes to mind is the situation in Boulder, where citizens voted recently to municipalize their power, and they had been getting power from Xcel Energy, and now they're exploring this other option. Now, would Wisconsin become the Wild West without the regulation that we have? I mean, I think that we've seen some real pitfalls of deregulation in California, and people remember that, and there needs to be some balanced approach. And so sometimes just the act of saying we want more and demanding more as ratepayers can have an impact on our utilities and what they're willing to do. There's things that people can do as shareholders, too, by bringing up resolutions. So I do think that there is room and a place for regulation. But at the same time, we can't let the monopoly control everything when people clearly want to do more for clean energy.
Andy Hasselbalch, I feel like I ought to give you a chance to speak in spirited defense of the regulated monopoly.
Well, the history on the monopoly is pretty straightforward. The notion of having multiple poles and wires and natural gas lines buried in communities for the physical distribution and interconnection was not deemed to be beneficial. So if you reached a point that you could have your own biomass box in your basement that provided you the reliability that you needed, and you didn't need any backup or the benefits of interconnection, any one of us could build a new home and put this wonderful little tool in our basement, and we wouldn't need the utility. But to the extent there is at least some role, whether it's just as a backup source or your full requirements, I think the model of the regulated utility, actually whether it's an investor-owned utility or a cooperative or a municipal utility, that model will have some role. The degree to that role will vary, and over time I expect it will change. On the natural gas side, the wholesale level of purchasing natural gas was deregulated back in the late 80s, and then it really expanded in the 90s. Independent power producers having large utility-scale projects throughout the state. Wind farm, the big wind farm on the west side of 41, is a third-party owned. So you certainly have migrations of non-utilities in the energy sector, but to the extent you need some backbone, I think there'll be a role that will be regulated at some level.
Let me get Gary Radloff's take, and then we'll take another question from the audience.
Well, I can't resist because this is a radio broadcast. I think what the image I like to use to describe what needs to occur is imagine a couple of radio dials, and we need to dial one dial down and dial another one up. And that's the way I kind of look at the regulated utility energy sector. As a society, we've invested a fair amount in them as shareholders and as a public entity. So I don't think it behooves us as a society to put them in a precarious economic situation. On the other hand, I think we need to change the rules of the game and allow for our regulated utilities to diversify, to reward them for energy efficiency investment, reward them for distributed energy investment, allow them to transition off of the high carbon energy system that we have today over time, and not put the shareholders at risk. I think anyone who has a pension fund might have some money in utility stock, whether they know it or not. So, I mean, there's bigger issues here that have to be kept in mind as we go through this energy transition. That's not to say that we continue to encourage bad policy that I think actually does punish the utility sector for not investing in things that they need to invest in, like efficiency, like technology innovation, like distributed generation. But I think we have to be careful as we make this transition. I think a complete move to deregulation could cause some significant economic instability.
Let's go to another question from the audience, and if you could introduce yourself and tell us your question.
Yes, my name is Todd Mihalik, and some of my Wisconsin state legislatures would have me believe that there's negative health aspects to clean wind power. What are some negative aspects to clean power?
Anybody want to take a crack at that?
There have been claims from certain groups about the potential for something called wind turbine syndrome. So people that are living next to wind farms, some of you may have heard complaints about things like insomnia or just anxiety, digestive problems, a whole list of things. And so much research has gone into this issue recently. And although, you know, Sierra Club's main concern when looking at a wind farm is, you know, how close is it to bird or bat migration routes? And luckily, it seems like with careful siting or with the timing of when the wind turbines go on at night, or that some of those issues can be mitigated. So first I'll say, anyone who uses lighting or energy, there's no form of energy that's absolutely scot-free. I mean, maybe some forms of energy efficiency, you'd be hard-pressed to find a downside, maybe somewhere in the manufacturing process. But all forms of energy do have some impacts. But in the research on health impacts related to wind farms, that has not been substantiated. And there have been large studies done by researchers in Australia. There was recently a large study, I'm not sure where it was produced, but a journal, Health and Psychology, published the results of that study. And basically they put people in a room, and they showed everybody a video of someone talking about wind turbine syndrome, and then they subjected some of the test subjects to infrasound or the something similar to what you'd hear near a wind farm. And if you've been near a wind farm or toured Glacier Hills or Forward Energy or any of the other developments in our state, it's a really not very noticeable when put up against something like Highway 94, for example. I mean, a lot of us live with a lot of background noise, but this is low frequency vibration that was worth researching because of all these complaints. And they did find that if everybody saw that video, the people that expressed anxiety beforehand, whether or not that they, you know, experienced infrasound as a treatment, complained about it. So basically, there's been a lot of study done on this, and they've never found anything. So the CDC hasn't recognized it. Peer-reviewed, published science hasn't found anything. And so I would say it's something new on the landscape, and people are apprehensive about it for a bunch of different reasons, whereas the coal plant and the fossil fuels that we burn that have a lot of proven negative impacts, we've just existed with them for so long. You know, that coal plant down the road that's been there, you know, 80 years or something, and the asthma and the other things that we live with, mercury in every water body in the state so that there are fish advisories. It's important to weigh energy sources. Now there's natural gas and it looks cheap, but then we get a lot of calls at the Sierra Club about all the sand in Wisconsin that's being used in the fracking process and how that's impacting habitat and people's health in terms of increasing silica dust in the air. So I think at the end of the day, we need to weigh each energy source carefully against, you know, the impacts on your pocketbook, the impacts on your health, and what people are going to be comfortable with in the future as we have to deal with these air pollution problems, climate change, and everything else.
Deborah Irwin, do risks or perceived risks surrounding wind energy enter into the Public Service Commission's equation?
Definitely. We evaluate those types of issues when looking at both individual projects and also sort of on a statewide basis. A couple of years ago, the legislature created an advisory group that's attached to the Public Service Commission. It's known as the Wind Siting Council. And the legislature actually charged that Wind Siting Council with looking into this very question. And so we're in the process right now of basically gathering all of the relevant literature that's available on this topic. And the Wind Siting Council will be working on a report to the legislature regarding the health impacts of wind.
We have about 10 minutes left in our conversation today, so let's go to another question from the audience, and please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Liz Nelson. I'm from ProSource Wholesale Floor Covering, and I have a few things. One, first of all, I'd like to ask if anyone on the panel has read the Peter Senge book, The Necessary Revolution. And the reason I ask that is that that book talks about necessary revolution as moving beyond the Industrial Revolution, and it starts to talk about systems thinking. And it's a very different way of thinking, and I think it's our best chance to move forward with whatever it is that we want to do. The second part is letting the millennials do what they do best. And I think we've got a group of people who are thinkers outside of what we are prone to thinking of. And lastly, it's a simple thing, and Gary, you kind of mentioned it. Let's not reinvent the wheel. Let's look at what the Norwegians are doing in utilizing compost and garbage.
Maybe Gary Radloff take on one or two of those issues. I don't know if you've read the book that she refers to, but
I'm sorry, I have not. But since my mother's maiden name was Ingebrigtsen, of course the Norwegians solved all this. No, I'm joking. I'm very intrigued by your question, though, because of the systems thinking component of it. I'm part of a team at the university that is actually trying to get all of our energy researchers to take a systems approach and use systems thinking to solving this problem, which has been a bit of a challenge, but I'll elaborate more offline on why that is. It has more to do with the way universities are set up. But I do think we need to approach this issue with a systems approach. And a very simple definition of systems thinking, because it's probably a long, long answer, is you try to solve the whole problem, not just silo it. It's not just about energy. It's about the environment. It's about the economy. It's about technology. It's about all of that. And you have to sort of put all of that into the package to solve it. The Department of Energy actually has been moving that way as well, which is somewhat encouraging. So I think long-term, we will be taking systems approaches to this energy issue. But it still is kind of an evolutionary process, and you raised that as well. I do think that's exactly where we are as a society right now, is we're making this shift, again, to what I call the legacy high-carbon energy economy, to this new energy economy built around clean technologies and built around more renewable sources. The question is, do we get to 100%, which is a very intriguing question and a lot of modelers are looking at. Could we do 100% renewables? Some people in the energy field say, well, no, not 100. There are some limits on that. But others say, oh, sure, we could. And so I think that's where a lot of research and a lot of thinking is going to go, which is what other technologies need to be matched up, what other systems, what other approaches with either existing technologies or hopefully new technologies to completely make that transition away from a high-carbon energy economy. Probably not going to happen in my lifetime, but I do think it can happen. I think parts of it may happen faster than we think. I believe that we are starting to look at an energy world that's going to look a lot more like the internet world and the telecommunications world. I know our radio listeners can't see this, but I have my cell phone here on the back of it. It has an old rotary dial on it, and then it's an iPhone on the other side. Well, I think the energy world is actually going to go through a very similar technology transformation, and it already is. So how quickly does that happen? I can't really tell you. I do think it really could be less than 10, 15 years.
I want to get Chuck McGinnis's take on that, because it seems like when we get into the into the realm of technology, you might have something to add there.
We've seen a philosophical shift in this country from around the concept of energy independence. Years ago, when you were talking about energy independence, it was kind of a national topic. After Katrina and 9/11, the governors, regardless of politics, the governors took ownership of energy independence, and they started redefining energy independence as being within their state lines. So, for example, the Indiana governor wanted to start burning corn. Places that had woody biomass started to burn wood. And now we're seeing another shift towards energy independence as it relates to the individual. We had somebody from Wauwatosa speak up just a few minutes ago. There's a concept called net zero, where buildings will actually produce electricity as opposed to being a net consumer, or at least be neutral. So we're seeing a shift. And what drives that shift? Technology. So as you see solar panels become more cost-effective, as you see different technologies become more effective as it relates to the smart grid, you'll see a continued push towards energy independence at the local level and within local governments.
Let's take a couple more questions, one from down center.
Tom Brandstetter. I live here in Milwaukee. I'm with a bunch of organizations. One of them kind of related to this is the First Unitarian Church. We did a major overhaul of the church, a historic building with insulation and solar panels and all that. And I can talk about that at length, but with feed-in tariffs, some of the other questions. But one of the numbers that was, we talked about a lot of numbers here, but the one really, really important number that was not talked about at all from the intergovernmental policy or kind of climate change, we must get to an 80% reduction of CO2 by 2050. That's only 37 years away from now. And I'm not seeing the urgency to get on that trajectory. Keeping that number in place, instead of talking about a 10% portfolio or whatever it is, we need an 80% reduction. And to back that up, I looked at my own footprint and cut my own personal footprint from cradle to grave by 80%, and I give presentations on that. Not that my footprint matters, but it's to inspire that this is possible, because this is basically a life or death sentence for maybe not the people in Wisconsin, but people in Bangladesh, the Maldives, and all that. We need to keep a goal. We need to set the bar higher. What is our goal? And so I guess the question is, are we taking that goal seriously or not?
Tom Contender, are people talking about that?
Well, I think people are talking more about climate change after what the year of extreme weather with hurricane, with Superstorm Sandy and other events last year, and even in Wisconsin, we saw some severe drought. We saw some just years after severe flooding, and we saw extreme heat. No one weather event is indicative of climate change, but if you look at the pattern, it's striking, and the Wisconsin Institute for Climate Change Impacts Initiative came out with a report 2 years ago that basically said that the kinds of things we saw last summer are basically in the forecast, if you will, for 2050 or 2100 on the current trajectory of a carbon-intensive economy that relies a lot on fossil fuels.
That has not translated to policy yet here.
No, not. It is on the national level to agree. That President Obama has talked about it in the State of the Union and in his inaugural address, which some people thought might perhaps make him consider this a legacy issue. But he's got a lot of other things he's dealing with right now.
Do we have one more question in the audience? We do. From the obstructed view seats. Those of you listening in on the radio, we have a very long cord that is making its way.
Great technology. Good morning. Kevin Crawford with Orion Energy Systems. There's no doubt to the fact that until utilities in Wisconsin can get paid for spinning the meter backwards, we're not going to see any quantum leap in change. I agree with all those comments made by the panelists, and thank you very much for your efforts this morning. Orion, like Johnson Controls, plays well in a sandbox with utilities from coast to coast. But the fact of the matter is that for all those utilities, any legislative change at the subnational level means risk. And so the utilities resist change dramatically. We'd like to be able to play in a sandbox where the ultimate benefit goes to the ratepayer, whether it's the person from the suburb in Milwaukee that can't put a photovoltaic system on her home, or a large customer of ours. But we're not getting in that direction, and I fear that statesmanship doesn't weigh into it very well because of the resistance of the economic impact of political contributions.
Gary Radloff, do you see the ratepayer as being represented in this equation?
Oh, yes, and I think increasingly more and more so that will be the case. But again, I want to preface that by the rules of the game may have to change. When I say rules of the game, I'm talking about administrative codes and statutory law. But the utilities listen to their ratepayers. I'll give them credit for that. And I think their ratepayers are starting to request change, you know, whether it's through things like demand response, whether it's through energy efficiency, energy conservation, whether it's through distributed energy. The ratepayer is definitely requesting change. I think there are some technologies coming already today. These don't have to be invented. That will allow for, I liked your analogy of the sandbox, where utilities and maybe innovative new companies can play together. I think one is the microgrid, which, in very simple terms, and I apologize for making it too simple, but it's sort of a mini grid system. It's power electronics in a box, if you will. And a microgrid can be a college campus, on a college campus. It could be at a military installation in the desert using solar power and generating power there. I think then when you combine that with energy storage, that suddenly we have some technologies that will allow for new innovations, new generation ideas. And I think those will allow the ratepayer to be an energy generator as well. So I think we're just kind of on the cusp of combining some existing technologies with what I hope are new technologies that sort of change the paradigm and flip things. When I talk to an audience, I always ask them how many people use energy, and of course every hand goes up, and I go, how many generate energy, and you know, maybe a handful go up. Well, again, I think that's the paradigm shift. I think we have to all contribute to the energy system, whether it's through energy efficiency, through net zero housing, or through generating our own energy at our home or our small business or our large business. But that's going to take some regulatory change and some technology innovation and a little bit of the stars aligning.
Well, that is going to, unfortunately, have to be the last word on our subject for today. And this moment, I imagine our panelists might stick around and chat with people informally after we're done here. Don't forget to listen in all this week on 89.7 WUWM to hear all of our Project Milwaukee features and interviews. This forum will air on Lake Effect Friday morning at 10, and you can revisit our Project Milwaukee segments at the Project Milwaukee page at WUWM.com. There are a good many people we want to thank, not the least of which are our panelists, Tom Content, Deborah Irwin, Gary Radloff, Andy Hesselbach, Shala Werner, and Chuck McGinnis. Let's give them a round of applause and thanks. We'd also like to thank our engineer, John Strelecki, our stage manager, Bonnie North, and the executive producer of the Project Milwaukee series, Annalise Hensel. Many thanks also to Discovery World at Pier, Wisconsin, for the logistical support and the use of this amazing space today. Thanks so much to all of the staff members in WUWM News and Lake Effect and throughout the station for making this show and this series possible. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you to all of you here in the studio audience and to our listening audience as well. You've been listening to a live Forum Project Milwaukee Power Switch from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Have a great day.